we broke every rule that I probably shouldn't admit, but we started a building without a signed lease, without financing, on land we didn't own, on a road that wasn't complete and it didn't have sewer, but we had a handshake deal.
Okay, so episode 27 of the Deal Ranch podcast, Landon Wyatt, founding partner of Childress & Klein. So we're here in the magnificent office, One Wells Fargo in Charlotte. Thanks for having me in the office and thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for asking.
Absolutely. So you guys are a historic developer, certainly nationwide, but certainly in the Southeast. You've made your mark on Charlotte, to say the least, and really helped grow it to what it is today. Something like 56 million square feet developed. I'm sure it maybe is closer to 60 million. Number one developer by square feet, I think, for the last 10 years in Charlotte too, which is quite fascinating. In somewhere around $3 billion in assets under management current day. So I really just want to hear the whole story of Childress Klein and your career being there from the very beginning. But do you want to give a brief intro on yourself and an overview of Childress Klein in modern date here?
Sure. Well, why don't I do my intro by way of just explaining our origin story?
That's right. Yeah.
I graduated from college and went to work for family business for a little over a year or so, decided that was not for me. So I went back to business school, University of Virginia. Coming out of Virginia, I was offered a job by Trammell Crow Company, which at that point in time was the largest developer in the nation, based in Dallas, but had a Charlotte office. And so it turns out that Charlotte office was actually run by Fred Klein and Don Childress. So when I came to Charlotte, there were like five of us.
Wow.
And my first job was actually leasing Charlotte Plaza, which is the building right across the street from us here, the black and silver glass building. Notably, it's now in receivership. We sold it 30 years ago. So yeah. I did no longer have any involvement in it. But started with that small group at Crow in the Southeast. I was named a partner at Trammell Crow Company after 3 years and was responsible for running our industrial business and what little suburban office we had here in the region. And in 1988, if you can recall the economic times, particularly in the Southwest, the Trammell Crow Company was undergoing a considerable amount of stress from deals gone bad, primarily in the Southwestern United States. But as a result, lenders and partners and institutions we'd worked with for years were looking at our deals in the Southeast and going, sorry, we can't participate because we're not happy with how your Dallas partners are treating us in.
Oh, wow.
Pick a number, pick a date, Phoenix. Mm-hmm. So we saw the handwriting on the wall, and Fred and Don came in one day and said, hey, we think we're going to leave Trammell Crow and start up our own business. Will you come with us and do it? And I said, sure. I've always been partners with you two guys, so that's an easy decision. So that was 1988 when we made that decision. There, we were actually, Trammell Crow Company was very regionalized, and the majority of the company was owned by those regional
partners,
operating partners. There had been two groups prior to us, Hamilton Partners in the upper Midwest, Chicago-based, Speaker Partners in the Pacific Coast, Northwest, that had done something similar. So we did the same thing, and I think that was when the handwriting was on the wall and Crow changed the rules and now is actually a subsidiary of CBRE. At any rate, we literally changed the name on the door, hired all offered all of our employees employment in the new company. Mm-hmm. All but I think two came with us, and we were off and running with Childress Klein.
Wow.
The way we started was because it was a partnership. we owned a lot of real estate in partnership with the Crow family and the Dallas partners. And we went through essentially a business divorce where we valued everything and divided up. You get this, we get that. And as a result, we ended up with a lot of office space and very little industrial space, which turned out to be a blessing in disguise because we borrowed a lot of money to leave Crow and start this business. And that put us on a bit of a forced sale program. And so we had a lot of office assets that we could capitalize on by selling. We did that, paid back the debt, and essentially rebuilt our business, started the industrial business pretty much from scratch because Crow took most of the industrial right. when we left, and rebuilt our office business. And then since have added, certainly had retail at the time, and since have added multifamily and self-storage businesses to our portfolio.
So to stop there at the 1988 window. So this building was one of the, I think you had 6 million office square feet is what they started.
That sounds
with,
about right.
Says the website at least. So this building was one in Lake Point, I believe, as
yes.
well. Okay. So how did those, because they developed them, obviously, when they were under TC, but what was the, how did that divorce or buyout go? Like did, because just trying to understand how much equity did, were they able to put in, or did they just have to borrow all of it? And then you guys sold some of the office assets back, you're saying?
Everything was owned in partnerships
yep.
where we, when I say we, me, Fred, Don, myself, yep. Owned generally greater than 55-60%,
oh,
with
okay.
the balance owned by the Crow family and Dallas partners. So we went through and valued everything, just did an asset swap. We took more than our share of office, more than our share of assets. That's where the borrowing money came in. So we didn't do a exact pari passu yeah. swap. We took more than our asset share, borrowed the money to do so, and then commenced on selling office buildings, particularly Lake Point,
yep.
Which we had developed. This building we actually kept until I think 2015 is when we sold this building, so not quite 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And redeployed a lot of the capital that we put back in our balance sheet into our industrial and multifamily business and self-storage mm-hmm. businesses.
Wow. So what were the early years like? What was the initial plan of, hey, where was their focus? Was it, hey, we want to go out and develop new office space? Or was it, we want to, I read somewhere like early 90s, maybe it was making a big push for industrial space. Like what was the plan of those two starting the business and you coming on? Like what was the initial focus for the first couple of years in getting the business off the ground?
Well, the beauty of how we were structured and continue to be structured is we address each, we call them product types, we
have okay.
verticals, industrial, office, multifamily, self-storage, retail. We address those independently. And so someone is responsible for running that particular business.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no allocation of capital or strategy to say, we're going to focus on industrial and we're not going to focus on retail. It's whoever was running that business put together whatever business they could and grew it accordingly.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, the businesses that were particularly successful in terms of mm-hmm. doing that were industrial, office, multifamily, well, and retail, self-storage as well, but probably in that order of magnitude is how we built the business.
And what was your initial focus when you right away? Was it industrial from the get-go?
My initial focus was industrial, yes.
Okay. Interesting.
Because we were starting essentially from scratch. We had to go out and find land positions, build buildings, get tenants.
Yeah.
I do remember making the comment that, well, I guess it's more fun to build market share than to protect it. Because we had a large industrial portfolio at the time we left Crow. But we had to start over, and it was a good thing.
Absolutely. So over the years, the first couple of years, like early 90s, I suppose, although you guys were already an established business that broke out, like you're still starting a business on your own with this new brand, what was the first significant deal you think that your industrial team did along the way? Like where was it where you're like, oh man, I think we can do something here. Like this, we've got a good run. North Park, Brookwood, maybe?
I think the first project, significant industrial project we did after we left was Brookwood, which is right at the intersection of 485 and 77, Southwest Charlotte. We had a long relationship with Norfolk Southern Corp that we had entered into a partnership with them on that land, started Brookwood as when the highway was coming through there. We ultimately, subsequently bought Norfolk Southern out and owned that outright, but that was our first significant industrial development. We own it to this day, all but two buildings.
And then as you went on and developed other industrial assets, what was kind of the exit strategy or the business plan for each asset? Was it to hold for a long period and lease and operate? Or when did you plan to exit and sell the assets that maybe generate liquidity for other deals?
Well, I think if you ask most brokers in the marketplace, they would say that they never sell, which is not entirely true. But our strategy for industrial was to build and hold. We like the dynamics of owning it.
Yeah.
The risks when it's empty of re-tenanting it are lower than, say, re-tenanting a big office building. So we wanted to build and own and maintain a large industrial operating portfolio. We clearly had to sell over time to strategically redeploy some capital, and we've done so. We developed, I'm looking at numbers. We developed about 25 million square feet of industrial. We currently own about 13 and a half, a little over 13 million square feet. So if you do the math, we have sold half of the industrial that we've done over the years. Now, a significant portion of that was what went to Crow, but even in the Childress Klein days, we have periodically sold off some assets to keep the machine running.
Wow. In those early years, what do you think was the biggest challenge for you as being, you know, one of the partners in leading the industrial sector, which as by square feet was half of the space you guys have developed to date, right? Of those 25 million out of the 50 or 60, being such a pivotal leader here, what do you think were the hardest times or what were the biggest challenges in those first maybe 5 or 10 years in building out the company?
Well, thinking back on the first 5 or 10 years of the company, we started in 88, 89.
Yeah.
You may not recall what happened in the early 90s, but it was a huge downturn. That was the origin of the Resolution Trust Corporation, and real estate was going south. It was a challenging environment in which to operate. So we had the economic headwinds. We had the strategy of trying to build and hold, which required more capital, which we were able to do by being more of a merchant builder in some of the other businesses. And then the biggest challenge or opportunity was getting the good people we have on our team, because that's really what makes it happen. We've got a lot of assets. They're great. But what's really important is the team of people that we have that have really built that portfolio and continue to run it and continue to manage it. And that is what's most important. And that was, I won't say necessarily the biggest challenge, but it was the biggest opportunity. And I think we succeeded at that in getting a great team.
How did you go about doing that? Was there anything that you really focused on, interview process or seeing guys work at other companies that you would acquire? Like, how did you grow folks into being such, you know, high-powered individuals? Or like, what did you look for in building your team that made them a good fit for here?
We really stuck with the old Trammell Crow model, which was, in some ways, pretty simple. We only hired graduates from top business schools. You had to have an MBA from a good school. You had to really want real estate because the compensation, the current cash compensation, was not particularly great. You had to be betting on the future.
Yep.
And then we started everyone in leasing space on the theory, which I think holds to a large degree today, that the people who should be developing and building buildings are the people who know what the tenants in those buildings want. And there's no better way to learn what tenants in the building want than to try and convince a lot of companies to move into your buildings, hear what's good, what's bad, what the brokers like, what they don't like. And that drives us to these to this day that our leaders tend to have come, have at least some exposure to the leasing process so they understand what our customers really want.
Yeah.
Now, as we've grown the business, we've had to get a good bit more specialized. I mean, my partner, Matt Harper, and I talked that we can't be the generalists that we used to be given the size of the business, but that philosophy still holds.
This episode of The Deal Ranch is brought to you by Reed's Jewelers. If you're looking for a new watch, Reed's has it. They have a large selection of fine Swiss timepieces from Omega, IWC, Breitling, Grand Seiko, Tudor, and Tag Heuer. Since 1946, Reed's has been devoted to customer service and quality. Find a Reed's store near you or shop online at Reed's.com. That's R-E-E-D-S.com by clicking the link in the show notes. Kind of in line with that, you guys have built and developed so many, well, other asset classes too, but developed so many great sites for industrial parks that have, you know, stood the test of time over these last 20, 30 years. Is there any secret in the sauce to finding and getting these sites? I mean, there are these large tracts of land. Like, how were some of these developments cultivated, especially in this area? Like, what did you guys focus on for getting these good sites and locations and drawing up the plans to develop these great parks? So what did business development look like, I guess, in short?
It's changed quite a bit over the years. Initially, our model has always been to go out and find a larger tract.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's definition of larger tract varies by market, but say 100 to 300 acres.
Okay.
That we could go in, entitle, do the infrastructure, and then have a program of building it out over what might be as long as 10 or 15 years, it might be as short as 5 years. Yeah. So that's been our model. In order to find those tracks early on, we had to be on the edge of growth because you can't find 100 acres of infill land typically. So we tended to look on the edge of the market's growth, try and find a site there and follow that model. It's gotten much more difficult to do so. Or put another way, the edge of growth is a lot farther out than it used to be.
Mm.
And so that has been our model. We've actually built up a land inventory currently of about 1,000 acres, which we can roughly, not quite double the size of our business, but we can probably build another 9 or 10 million square feet on land we currently own and are entitled. So the business is set to go forward for foreseeable future from a land standpoint. But that is the hardest part of our business, is finding good sites and getting control of them, getting them entitled, getting them developed, and holding on to them through good times and bad.
Yeah.
When you have a model like that, you're anticipating building something out over a 5 or 10 year period. Whatever performers you have, the one certainty is you're going to be wrong.
Mm.
Another relative certainty is in that time frame, there's going to be a downturn. You just don't know when it's coming. So we have tried to approach what is fundamentally a fairly risky business with very conservative capitalization and approach.
How do you do that exactly? Is there anything you can do to hedge the position? Because you're essentially buying the land and holding on to it, paying interest years or for this 5-10 year period and not knowing when you'll be able to build. Or maybe you have an idea of when you'll be able to build and it quickly changes. So like, how do you guys conceptualize how you handle that risk over a decade of a project like that?
I think there are two keys. One is don't use debt to buy land.
Yeah.
Buy land with equity, cash. Second is in the deal structure, make sure interests are aligned. Because if interests are not aligned, at some point they're going to be at cross purposes and you're going to have to deal with it. So our deals have tended to be very simple, pari passu. We're all equal. What's good for one is good for all, and what's bad for one is bad for all. So we've attempted to make sure every deal that we have is structured that way. In fact, our deals are frankly pretty programmatic.
Mm.
The ownership stack, the operating agreement, the way we set up every deal is pretty much the same as the one before it. We don't recreate the wheel.
And what has been the, the source on the land deals? Is it a heavy internal brokerage that your guys just calling and knocking on doors, so to speak, over years? Or do you find like the majority of the, you know, these new sites that you're getting on the edge of town, so to speak, are from long-term relationships you've already had? Like, where do you think
it's all of the above? And you're hearkening back to earlier comment of not being able to specialize, not being able to generalize the way we started out and still think is a good model. That's how I spend a lot of my time. It has been acquiring land and getting it developed. Chris Daly, my other partner, does similar. So we've gotten a little bit more specialized in terms of how we approach it. But I think while we're still interested in land sites and still out there looking, we're in pretty good shape from a land inventory standpoint. So it's not to say we're not going to do it anymore. We're going to emphasize it less than we have been.
At what point, I think we covered the early days really well there. At what point over time, how does your role start to change as a leader over time through the company? And where do you see the company really start to shift gears? You're talking about in 88 spinning off and let's, you know, get deals where we can and get started. And then later on, you're building these luxury high rises in town here. So there's a big gap. Like, at what point do you see... And how do you see the company evolving? And then obviously through this time period, 2008, you know, is obviously challenging to every real estate business. So how did you see the company evolve over time? And guess what were you thinking along the way as you saw it?
Well, the number one thing, as I said, is we, given the scale of the business, we can't be as much of a generalist. Each of us individually cannot be as much of a generalist as we started.
Yeah.
So we have to divide and conquer, which as long as you've got a good team and you empower them to make decisions and give them good support, then that's how you go about it. So my role has gone from a jack of all trades, buying land, building buildings, leasing mm-hmm. space, getting financing, to making sure that all the people who do those things have whatever resources they need, be it capital relationships, bank relationships, brokerage relationships, making sure that we have that our team has the resources to do what we do.
One thing that stuck out that I was really curious about, obviously being a real estate company that's stood the test of time, how did you guys successfully navigate kind of 2008 for owning so much real estate? What did that cycle look like for you? And what was kind of the initial window of seeing it happen? And where did you see it affect the business initially?
What's interesting, we went back and I recall somewhere around 2006, 2007, Fred and I looked at each other and said, if we really had strength of conviction, we would sell everything right now. Because the capital markets were telling us it was worth a lot more than, frankly, we believed it was worth. Mm. So there was a tremendous disconnect between the capital markets and the underlying real estate markets.
Just via cap rates on what?
Essentially, yeah. Okay. Cap rates versus the underlying fundamentals of demand for space and supply for space. Wow. That was a big disconnect, which fast forward to today, there's a similar disconnect, mm-hmm. only it goes the other way. At that point in time, we had actually slowed down and had essentially stopped building new product in 2008. We went through our portfolio and tried to identify every tenant who is somehow related to home building, because home building was clearly driving what was going on in the 2008, 2009 crisis. So we tried, whether it's as obvious as an actual home builder or as less obvious a granite supplier or pool construction company. And we discovered that approximately 16-17% of our portfolio was exposed to the home building business. We took note of that. There's not much we could do other than be aware of it. But we actually instituted a process, because tenants would come and say, hey, we can't pay our rent. We instituted a process to go through it and say, okay, how are you? Give us your financials. Give us your business plan. We became a like a bank credit office. Tell us why you can't pay your rent, and we'll work with you to come up with a plan to get to the other side of this. We did that. We did lose tenants. I think we went from probably, at least our stabilized portfolio, went from probably 95% leased to 85% leased over that several-year period. So we had a lot of inventory, but it was not because we built it. It was because it was vacated.
Mm.
And we got through that period, I think, by being a reasonable cooperative landlord. We also had sort of 85% plus of our tenant base that was maybe not having fun, but they weren't related to home building. So
right.
they were going to be okay. And we came out the other side. And while my friends in finance and economists would say the market turned in 2009, really for our real estate business, it really didn't turn until probably 2012, 2013. Wow. When we really started to see things pick back up.
As far as vacancy was low for those 3-4 years or trending down, or just not able there to develop new sites?
I think there was a lack of demand for space. Back to the real estate. When I say real estate fundamentals, I'm referring to demand for space and supply for space.
Wow.
Setting aside the capital stack and who wants it and how much they value it. But in terms of like a manufactured product, we're manufacturing space for people who need space.
Yeah.
And the I think the dynamics of that supply demand really came around in probably 2012, where once again there was there was increasing demand for space relative to existing supply. And so rents started to grow. It started to make sense to build new product. And we probably didn't build anything for 3 or 4 years, which was very unusual.
So what does that look day to day for you if you're not able to develop new sites or not even planning on it for those 4 years? What's the bulk of your time spent on during those 3 or 4 years?
Trying to keep it full. Trying to keep the train running. We still had existing tenants who leases expired. Some needed to grow, some needed to shrink. So we dealt with our existing portfolio, stabilized that. We do all our own management and leasing. Yeah. So there's a lot to be done, even when there's no new development to be done.
Maybe this is caused by that timeline, but I saw in 2013, you guys looks like got into the acquisition business. Typically had not before, says the company timeline on the website. So was the 2013 the start of, or the interest in acquiring new deals, was that just a byproduct of things being cheap on the market at the time and you guys saw the opportunity? What was the interest for the company to not just develop anymore and start an acquisition arm to the business?
I'd like to say we were smart and saw that, but that would not be true.
Okay.
We really looked around and said, hey, we've got a skill set in-house that understands real estate. We're accustomed to sort of producing that real estate, but the same skill set can be directed towards acquiring. We have probably been more successful in acquiring office, where we've been much more of a not entirely. We still own probably a little over 1 million square feet of office, but we've been much more of a merchant builder in office. Yeah. And so we've been more successful there. We've not been particularly successful in the industrial, frankly, because when you're, to look at it from a generic viewpoint, when you're a wholesale producer, it's hard to be a retail buyer. It's hard to get your head into that space.
Yeah.
So we've looked at some, but our acquisition intentions have been primarily on office.
Interesting. This market, to say the least, has been extraordinarily good to you guys and a lot of people here in Charlotte. It's grown immensely, especially since you started. I maybe read something from an article Fred was in a long time ago, but he said, like a lot of real estate guys do. You know, I was lucky that I found the Charlotte market because I guess Don and Fred were in Philadelphia when they started working together, yes. And then they split up, which is neat. When over the last 35-ish years, what did you see as like big economic development factors for the growth of the Charlotte market, and how did those things kind of impact you? Were there any what big thing, development of a new school or hospital or any large economic factor that besides COVID obviously was a good one for this region too, but anything prior to COVID that sticks out in your mind of, hey, that really helped our business? Or,
well, make no mistake, we're in the right place at the right time.
That's
and
right.
And
that's
we
right.
recognize that.
Yeah.
You can be as smart and capable and diligent as you want, but without job growth and employment growth and population growth, you're pushing a string. There's just no demand. So we're lucky to be in markets where people are moving there. Charlotte, what's the number? 130 people a day moving to Charlotte. They all have to live somewhere, work somewhere, shop somewhere. So we're in a good spot where there's economic growth. But if you narrow it down into our probably the areas where we've been most active have been Charlotte, Charleston, and Atlanta. In Charlotte in particular, I could point to, I think, three things. Number one, number two, number three, probably the top five are all the airport.
Yeah.
U.S. Airways.
Said one
now
through
America,
five?
Yeah. I think it's hard to underestimate the impact that has on Charlotte, that maybe the fares aren't cheap, but businesses can get virtually anywhere in the country without making a stop. And that has been a tremendous magnet for businesses locating in Charlotte because it's so easy to get around to your various locations or customers. So that has been the number one driver of our region. Certainly the center city benefited greatly from the competition between Hugh McCall and Ed Crutchfield.
Yeah.
Originally NCNB and First Union, now Bank of America and Wells Fargo, ultimately. But they drove the development of the center city. They brought businesses in to the center city. I recall having friends who were investment bankers or traders in New York getting recruited to Charlotte, and they said, this is a big risk for me, a investment banker moving from New York to Charlotte, because if I lose my job in New York, I got 20 other places I can look. If I lose my job in Charlotte, there's one other place I could look, and I'm damaged goods because I'm from the other team. And to think about moving from that sort of mindset to Charlotte being one of the financial centers of the country is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
What growth took place. And the third thing I'd say is we have had a very business-friendly governing environment. We all like to complain.
Mm-hmm.
Regulations are everywhere. But generally speaking, historically, Charlotte city government and county government has been business-friendly and honest and straightforward. So we've benefited from that.
Wow. I've got quite a few questions to get through still, and then I want to talk about some deals. But what do you think for you guys as a company, in such a prestigious company to last all these years and develop so many great assets? There are a lot of other developers in this market too and nationwide. What do you think has been a competitive advantage for the company that allowed you guys to outperform, you know, most people through this period of time as well? What's a competitive advantage, or what's something you guys focus on at the company? You think that goes?
I think it's two things. One, we've had a commitment from our partners to retain a lot of the capital in the business. So when we do make a profitable sale, typically speaking, a lot of that will stay in the company. So we've got a very, very strong balance sheet that gives us the ability to develop going forward. But the other, and probably equally, if not more important, is the people. We have a lot of people with a lot of tenure.
Mm.
Because we've hopefully created a great environment where people want to spend the better part of their careers and enjoy working with each other. So there's certainly an esprit de corps that is hard to quantify, but really a big part of our success, because there's a lot of institutional knowledge that walks in and out the door every day. We own a lot of assets. They're great. Mm-hmm. But without the people who really know how they tick and know how to make those happen, we're just another asset manager, which we are not.
Fascinating. For your years going through the business, you've been in the real estate business for so long. What has kept you in the real estate business? That was one of my first questions for you. I forgot to ask. What do you love most about the business, and what keeps you interested in real estate over time?
I'm just lucky. Mm. I remember being sent to some program in high school that explored interests and strengths, and you know, sort of a week-long deal with other high school students.
Yeah.
And one of the exercises that I remember is they put us all in a room with everything you can imagine. Books. There were no computers at that time, but had there been, I'm sure they would have been there. Toys, art supplies, you name it, it was in there. And they said, we want you to spend a half a day and come out of there with something. Well, what I came out with was a building that I'd made out of cardboard or paper or something. And I think it's that point they said, well, you should really consider architecture. And yeah, maybe, but what it told me is I really liked buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember in my career prior to business school, I was way more interested in the building and construction than I was in the actual business that was going on in those. And so when the opportunity presented itself at Crow to go build buildings and
lease them,
lease them and spend time around buildings, like, wow, you're going to pay me to do this? So I've just always liked building buildings. It's a physical product. You get to see it every day. Mm-hmm. The nature of what we do is you're engaged in different activities across the days and the weeks. You're not doing the same thing all the time, because it takes a lot of different skills to buy land, build a building, finance it, lease it, design it, all those things. So it's a career that offers a lot of different opportunities for growth, challenge.
Last question before kind of covering a couple deals, if you would like to, maybe a little bit more philosophical, but like for you, what are your core principles as being a deal maker, having, you know, been a part of so many different developments and leased them and been a part of the deal from the very beginning? What would be the kind of your core principles, or like what is the keys that you focus on, just fundamentals of real estate? Like what do you think maybe you do well, or you really focus in on as far as buying a deal, or maybe the length of the deal, or even negotiating, that you do maybe better or different than other folks? Like what do you really care about, so to speak?
I don't know whether they're better or different, but I think the keys that drive us and me are, we look at real estate as a long-term asset that we're going to own. Now, we may or may not own it, but our thought process is, what's going to happen to this building in 10 years? What's going to happen to this building in 20 years? What's going to happen to this building in 40 years? Or location is probably more the question in that kind of time frame. So when you do that, you think about the quality of construction. You think about the quality of the roof. So if we've got 13 million square feet of industrial roofs that we know are going to have to be replaced at some point in time.
Yeah.
A certainty. So we think about how we design roofs accordingly. So regardless of what the ultimate strategy is for an asset, we approach it as a long-term owner. That's our thought process.
Fascinating.
That's probably the biggest driver of how we go about it. And the second thing is, in terms of structuring, again, structure it like a long-term owner, even if you're not, which means interests have to be aligned. The capital stack has to be conservative enough to weather good times and bad. And I think those two thought processes are really what drives everything that we do.
Interesting. In slowly wrapping up here, are there any, I highlighted a few and we chatted about them a little bit earlier, but if you want to tell a couple different deal stories, you're more than welcome to. I'd love to hear them, but a couple projects, and we can talk about any deal that maybe was most creative, challenging, significant in your career here, or significant for the company. Could be Music Row, the Global Technology Center is neat. I think two record setters there, but this building is magnificent as well. And then Museum Tower is very neat too. But is there any deal story or a couple that stick out in your head as like significant to you or a great story to hear?
Thinking back, one of my favorite stories is probably an industrial story. Yeah. This would have been in, the mid-80s. IBM had a large manufacturing campus in North Charlotte, which is no longer, the buildings are still there, but that's no longer a presence. They had a need for about a 400,000 square foot warehouse. And the broker who brought it to us introduced us to IBM. We didn't own the land, but we identified a site that was on a road that was under construction. It wasn't even open.
Wow.
It was relatively close. It's Harris Boulevard now. Okay. It's relatively close to the IBM campus. So they liked it. And we sat down with the IBM real estate director and worked out a deal essentially on the back of a piece of paper. And we broke every rule that I probably shouldn't admit, but we started a building without a signed lease, without financing, on land we didn't own, on a road that wasn't complete and it didn't have sewer. But we had a handshake deal with IBM, and they needed a certain delivery date. And by gosh, we were going to deliver it on that date. And we had to do all those things in order to meet that delivery. Well, obviously the lease got signed. We did close on the land. Everything worked out, and IBM was in there for a long time. We still own the building to this day. IBM's no longer a tenant. But that was one where I think our highlighted our approach is we're going to do whatever it takes to make our ultimate customers happy. Wow. And that's what we had to do. The building we're sitting in, formerly known as One Wells Fargo, started its life as Two First Union. First Union's headquarters were across the street. We were building this building for their expansion. While I don't recall how tall it was, how many stories it was, but the building's 42 stories. It was probably 10 or 15 stories in the air from a structure standpoint when First Union decided, well, we want to make this our headquarters. Can you make it bigger? Okay, we'll figure out how. So we figured out how to make it bigger while it was under construction. And essentially, what was Two First Union became One First Union, the headquarters, and they moved their trading floor into it. So we enlarged the building while it's under construction. We had an adjacent site, which could have been anything, but First Union, because of their headquarters, wanted it to be a hotel. We said, we don't really want to do a hotel because we don't know. I guess we'd had a little bit of exposure to hotels, all of which was not good.
Yeah.
But we teamed up with First Union and ultimately built the hotel, which is now a Hilton. It started its life as an Omni and owned that for a number of years before ultimately selling it for basically what we had in it, but a successful venture nonetheless. Other deals have worked out better. Obviously, that the Lowe's Tech Hub and South End was a home run. Timing was fantastic. Interestingly, that building was built as Lowe's Tech Hub with an adjacent site for their expansion. COVID hit, They didn't occupy the building. I think today it is essentially a landing pad for their tech group, but it's not something that someone goes to every day. Yeah. Needless to say, they're not going to need the expansion space. We still own the site next door.
Sure.
It will probably come to life as a high-rise multifamily deal at some point in time, because Lowe's doesn't need the office space. And the office space, you know, the office industry, if you will, is quite challenged right now. I think it's still sorting itself out as to how much office space is going to be occupied and where is it going to be occupied. There are, three or four buildings in the center city that are in receivership, meaning the court is overseeing essentially a foreclosure because they're not occupied.
Mm.
Not occupied enough to pay the operating expenses and debt service. So it's a challenging environment. But as I said, our ultimate goal is to figure out what our customers need and do whatever we can within our power to make that happen, even if it's not quite conventional, I'll say.
Interesting. This was at the time of completion, the tallest building in Charlotte as well?
Briefly.
Okay. A couple of years maybe?
Yeah. Yes.
And did you guys operate that hotel, own and operate it, or there was someone else operating that?
Well, Omni was the operator.
Oh, okay.
But we learned that the hotel is an operating business, which has operating leverage, and leverage cuts both ways, on top of a real estate business, which has leverage, and leverage cuts both ways. And really came away thinking, there is no faster way to lose money than to develop and run a hotel. There's probably no faster way to make money, because the flip side of that,
sure.
But that's not what we do. We're not good at it, and there are people out there who are very good at it, and we recognize that, and we try to stay in our lane.
Wow. In wrapping up, is there anything we missed about the CK story kind of in totality, or anything else you wanted to highlight deal-wise that we missed kind of so far?
Not so much deal-wise. Yeah. As I said, I think our biggest businesses are industrial and multifamily, and in both of those businesses we have great portfolios, but also great site pipelines that we own that we will be able to continue to build on. But you asked earlier about what's the ultimate direction of the company strategically, and really that's going to be up to the people who are here and who are the younger generation that will ultimately be the leaders. I am clearly on the back nine of my career, and I recognize that.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to be, I will be for a time, but ultimately there are people younger than I who are in this office who are going to be running this business, and where it goes is wherever they want it to go. I will continue to be an investor in the business and an owner in it, but I'm not going to be running it forever. So there's another generation coming along.
That makes sense. Well, these kind of go hand in hand with that question. I was going to say, overall, what's the team focused on now? And is there any asset class, market, or service that you guys haven't been in that you would like to at any point in time? And I know you just said you're on the back nine, but is there any thing in your real estate career or for CK as a whole that you've guys pretty much done a lot of it or done it all, but is there anything in particular, a new space that you would like to get into, or a new market or new asset type?
Well, we like the Southeast. There are a handful of markets that we're not currently active in, Raleigh, Nashville, that sort of stand out as places that we may be able to do what we do. Mm-hmm. So time will tell on those. In terms of activities, we, as I mentioned, have not been really a merchant builder historically. That's certainly a strategic direction that we could add to our services, if you will. Go in with the GPLP model that is geared towards building something, stabilizing it, selling it, and moving on. That's not something we've done a lot of, but we certainly recognize it's something we can do and probably will do in certain markets. So we've got a lot of opportunities, and the limitation is not opportunities. The limitation is the capacity of our people to do those things and to willingness to travel to go to those places where those opportunities exist.
I love it. Last question for you, unless you had anything else you wanted to add. Who do you think in your career helped you the most along the way? Like, is there anyone you felt like you learned an exceptional amount from, and maybe Don or Fred as well? But like, who do you think was very influential in your real estate career to you?
Wow. I
mean, and how? Yeah.
I guess I default to two people. Certainly Fred and Don, but I was obviously Fred and our desks were literally next to each other. We sat 10 feet away from each other our entire careers. So, and I learned an enormous amount from him on how to operate real estate and how to run a business, how to start and run a business. And, you know, I guess the other I would attribute to my parents, who instilled in me the importance of education, learning as much as I could and excelling at that. And I particularly liked business, so that's the direction I went. And my father, who I think learned this from his father, and early in business, he said, gave me the advice. He said, never ask anyone to do anything that you wouldn't do yourself if you could. And that has sort of stuck with me. And that's not specific to real estate, but that's stuck with me in my entire career in terms of how I approach what we do and how we deal with people internally and externally.
Wow. Since you alluded to it a couple times, being on the back nine, what is your main focus outside of work right now? Personally, I figured I'd ask that. I typically don't, but like, what do you look forward to outside of the business right now, or maybe potentially what's even next?
Well, I love to play golf. So there's certainly that, but my, all three children are somewhat involved in real estate. My daughter is a designer with a large commercial architecture firm in Atlanta. And I like helping her think about her career in real estate. Two sons who had spent a number of years each, one at Carlyle in their U.S. real estate fund and one at Jamestown, which is a big, large German real estate fund. And they have actually gone into business together doing real estate investment.
Oh, wow.
Specifically industrial. So I look forward to helping them, advising them, growing their business. It's their deal. It's not mine. They're not working for me, nor do they want to, or nor will they. But shoot, I may work for them. Who knows?
That'd be awesome. Landon, I think this is a great place to wrap up. Thanks for doing this. This was great to hear your story. Is there anything else you wanted to add or anything that we missed in wrapping up?
No, this was more fun than I would have thought.
There you go. Perfect. Thanks, Landon.
Thank you.